Your Honor, may it please the court. We're here this morning because the district court erred as a matter of law in issuing a preliminary injunction to Water Gremlin to conduct lead testing and potentially abatement at residences of the homes of Water Gremlin employees. The preliminary injunction is beyond the scope of the Department of Health statutory authority under Minnesota Statute 147.075, which is the statute that applies to MDH. It's also beyond the scope of Minnesota Statute 182.662, which is the statute that applies to the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, which is administers the Minnesota OSHA program in the state. Minnesota Statute 145 allows a district court to abate as a public nuisance the activity or the failure to act that affects public health. Here we have a private harm, lead in private residences, and the activity affecting public health, as the district court found it, was the migration of lead from Water Gremlin's plant to those homes. Yes, Your Honor.
Could you step back a second for me? The statute you just cited was 145.
It's 145.075, Your Honor. I'll refer.
Okay, so that's what I thought you said. I just wanted
right.
to be clear
you
before
the wrong
I
number,
before
I
ask my question.
Right.
So 145.075, but you said it allows the court to order abatement. I thought you were arguing that the statute doesn't allow.
No, it allows the court to issue injunctive relief as a public nuisance to enjoin the activity or failure to act that affects public health.
I think you misspoke earlier.
I misspoke.
This might be easy.
It is far from easy, Your Honor. I apologize for misspeaking. No, that's the whole point. The statute 145, which won't worry about the 75, but statute 145 does not allow for the abatement of at least the Water Gremlin's position is it does not allow for that abatement.
It's not just a public nuisance. It's, quote, public health nuisance. And even if we were to adopt your view, the record shows that there are employees of Water Gremlin who have an excessive amount of lead in their systems, and in order to reduce that, so that would seem to be Water Gremlin's problem. And if it's because of lead, because of Water Gremlin's lax practices in making sure that lead doesn't migrate, in order to actually remediate that, don't you have to clean up their cars and their homes where they're being exposed to continual amounts of lead just for the employees?
No, Your Honor. First of all, the record.
Why not?
Let me explain.
Okay.
The record, and you'll find it in the declaration of Carl Dubois and the declaration of Mr. Askin in Water Gremlin's opposition to the motion for a preliminary injunction. The record specifically shows that Water Gremlin employees' lead levels are actually well below the thresholds for the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry has.
But that doesn't say anything about the levels of lead that are on their clothing that get in their cars and get in the homes.
That's correct.
So
Your
is that relevant?
Well, I was responding to the suggestion that the record shows that blood lead levels were elevated with employees. They are not.
Well, but paragraph 16 of the declaration of Stephanie Yendell, dated October 28, 2019, says that they're high enough to trigger a report to Minnesota OSHA.
That seems
to contradict what you're saying.
The reporting statute has a different threshold than the Minnesota OSHA statutory requirements. What the district court correctly found is that there are no regulations specifically dealing with what we're calling here take-home lead, that is, lead that is migrating out of Water Gremlin's facility. The focus of the Department of Labor and Industry and under Section 182 is specifically on the plant. Those issues have been enjoined, and Water Gremlin, as the record shows, has been working with Ramsey County and working with the Department of Labor and Industry to address clean exit.
But we're dealing with the health department and public health And public health is not restricted. I mean, all we have to do is read the headlines today that COVID-19 is now around the world. So if you can't remediate what's causing the public health nuisance, then isn't this kind of a meaningless statute?
We are remediating, or Water Gremlin is in the process of remediating, working with the state, what is causing the public health nuisance, which is what the district court found was the migration of lead out of Water Gremlin's facility. That's being addressed right now, even as we speak, at Water Gremlin. The justification...
But not in the homes and cars, which seems to me to be a logical... I mean, it failure to act seems to imply an affirmative injunction, correct?
There is an affirmative injunction to enjoin specific activities at the Water Gremlin facility. And by the way, Water Gremlin voluntarily agreed to clean cars and car mats. The difficulty is when you go beyond that into private homes, that's where you have a problem with respect to a public health nuisance. The point.
Well, but cars, I mean, so what's the difference between a private car and a private apartment, as long as the employee consents? I get, you know, the employee doesn't want anybody in their apartment.
That's another issue. Your Honor, the only specific difference and the only reason Water Gremlin agreed to clean cars, the analysis is the same. It should not apply. But the cars are actually physically coming to the facility. And so Water Gremlin agreed as a matter of settlement to clean those cars. It shouldn't be punished for wanting to go forward with respect to addressing cars.
You're suggesting that they're not required under the statute to clean the cars.
That is correct. The application is of Section 145 would be the same to private property. That's the point. We argue in the briefs that there is no public nuisance or no public health nuisance for the reasons set forth in the briefs. It's not applying to the public in general. It's not like COVID-19. It's not like the coronavirus. It doesn't apply to the public in general. It applies to
It goes beyond the employees themselves, and the district court found that the community that's impacted is the community of employees, their families, their friends, and all those who may have contact with them or their property. So this is a problem that affects the public. It doesn't just affect Water Gremlin's employees. Can you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I don't. The rationale, again, when you look at the concept of public nuisance or public health nuisance, as the case law that we've cited in the brief suggests, it's not the number of the potential parties that are affected. It's the question of, is there a public right? Is there a right to, say, air, water, public right-of-way, and the like?
Here, but the statute itself doesn't limit a public health nuisance to air and water.
No, but it uses the term public health nuisance. It could have omitted that completely. The statute at one point used the term public nuisance. It kept the public nuisance term and added health in 1987. When the legislature drafts a statute with common law terms, you interpret those. You have to give some meaning to those terms, and you have to interpret it in the context of the common law. And when you have a public nuisance in the context of common law, you have some sort of effect on a general public right.
There are other statutes that refer to public health nuisance and that incorporate the home. So,
actually, they do, Your Honor. But in those statutes, the abatement order for that public nuisance or public health nuisance goes to the owner or the occupier of the property. There is not a single statute.
But that doesn't mean it's not a public health nuisance.
It may be a public health nuisance, but then that's our second argument,
that
even if it is a public health nuisance, it is beyond the scope of the statute and beyond the scope of the language in the statute.
I'm sorry.
To abate private property. That's the argument. And there's nothing in all the other statutes, the lead poisoning statutes, the other statutes, the abatement order is specifically to abate a public nuisance, if there is one. The abatement order is specifically directed to the owner or the occupier of the property. There's no statute and no case law cited by the commissioners, and there just isn't any.
I think there is. There's the private nuisance statute, and that requires the person that creates the private nuisance, that allows the court to enter a judgment that the nuisance may be enjoined or abated, as well as damages recovered. And so, you know, you can create a private nuisance anywhere. I mean, it's not limited to the person who's in the home.
You can, Your Honor, but Section 140...
A company could create a private nuisance.
It absolutely could. There's no question about that. But that issue, with due respect, is not before this court and was not before the district court.
I thought you just said that the only order abatements, the only statutes that require abatement require the homeowner to abate. And my point to you is I think the private nuisance statute is different than that.
It is. I'm talking about the only statute that uses the term public nuisance or public health nuisance. That's in the restatement section 480A and the unreported case that we cited, the Bussier case. It says that in the context of a public nuisance, the order is directed to the owner or occupant of the property.
Water Gremlin own its property?
It does not own it does own its property, and it is addressing those issues at its facility right now under Section 182. It does not own the residences of its employees. That's private property, just as it does not own the cars of its employees.
If the court does not have authority, as you argue, to order remediation of these properties under Section 182.662 or 145.075, what avenue do these families have to get their homes tested for lead and remediated if unsafe levels of lead are found?
They could request that the Minnesota Department of Health test their homes, but not require Water Gremlin to pay for that testing. That's one thing that they could certainly do.
Are you suggesting that Water Gremlin has no responsibility even if the lead found in the homes is take-home lead from the Water Gremlin employees?
It has no responsibility under Section 145. That is correct. And the other thing to remember is the procedural posture of this case. We're in the context of a preliminary injunction. Water Gremlin has had no discovery. It has had no opportunity to test the link that the commissioners cite from Water Gremlin to the homes.
Whose fault is that?
I beg your pardon?
I mean, whose fault is that Water Gremlin has not presented any evidence of a link? I mean, this was a preliminary injunction, temporary injunction, you know, whatever you call it.
Right.
And the state came forward with evidence. And isn't it then incumbent in responding to a motion for preliminary injunction for the other side to come forward with evidence?
The state did come
forward. So is that the state's fault?
No, I'm not ascribing fault here, Your Honor. Just understand that the Water Gremlin did offer declarations in response to the preliminary injunction. The complaint was filed in a couple of days. We filed something 2 days later, and we've been addressing those issues with respect to the preliminary injunction going forward. Water Gremlin has worked cooperatively with the state in the context of this preliminary injunction going forward. The only issue that we are raising is this particular issue. So I'm not talking about fault. I'm just saying that, unlike the commissioner's suggestion that all the facts here have been waived, that is exactly not the case. In fact, the district court's order of December 27th in its findings of fact specifically said that given the procedural posture of the case in the context of a preliminary injunction, all of its findings of fact issued in that December 27th order were not with prejudice to Water Gremlin, because Water Gremlin will have the opportunity to test that causal connection.
What does Water Gremlin believe to be its stronger position on the statute? The fact that the argument that the statute reference to enjoining does not include abatement, or the argument that the statute refers to public health and public health nuisance as opposed to private health issues?
I think that both arguments are strong, Your Honor. I think the stronger argument is is the focus on what the scope of the injunction is. That is, as a public nuisance, the activity or failure to act that adversely affects public health. That is focused on Water Gremlin's facility. And then Water Gremlin is working through those issues and has been extremely proactive in working with the state. The problem is when you take that language in 145 and by an attempt to construe the language, you extend the remedy or you create a remedy that isn't there. That's Water Gremlin's argument.
Did you have another?
Any other questions?
Question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You all have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Go ahead when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Cerdo on behalf of the respondents. The district court in this matter did not abuse its discretion when it issued an injunction requiring the appellant, Water Gremlin, to clean up toxic take-home lead dust that had exited its plant and entered community homes. It made explicit factual findings that were not clearly erroneous to support that finding, and it relied on a correct interpretation of the law, which was not erroneous. Now, one of the things that came up very early a moment ago in Mr. Lightfoot's argument was the standard that he wanted this court to apply. And he said that the district court erred as a matter of law in finding that it had the authority to issue the injunction that it did. To be clear, Your Honors, this case involves intensive factual consideration of what the hazard at issue is, the toxic lead dust, and how it's affecting the community and whether it affects the public. Those are factual findings that are subject to a clear error standard of review.
Can I ask a question? So 145.075 was amended, and this phrase public health nuisance was inserted. What limitations are there on a district court's powers or on the commissioner of health under that provision to seek an injunction? I mean, it's defined as something that's adverse to public health.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which admittedly is pretty broad. So what standards are there governing that? What's to stop the commissioner of health, if we accept the state's argument, what's to stop the commissioner of health from saying sugary soft drinks cause obesity, terrible for public health? I want an injunction banning the consumption of, I mean, setting aside due process, right, constitutional issues. What's to prevent the commissioner of health from doing something like that? What are the standards? When are you at a public health nuisance so that a district court could recognize that?
Sure, Your Honor. A couple of answers. One is this. This statute, while broad, still has the requirement that there needs to be an activity or a failure to act engaged in by the defendant that is adversely affecting health and that is adversely affecting public health. So all of those factual pieces need to fall into place. Second, the commissioner does not unilaterally decide when there's a public health nuisance that needs to be enjoined. The commissioner needs to go to a court and explain why an injunction is necessary and needs to establish that these factual predicates exist. So there are checks and balances in place there. As a practical matter, this statute has not, at least as far as I think anybody is aware of in a reported case, been used. So it's not like it's being abused in the type of scenario that you're envisioning, much less when we're talking about the facts of this case, where we have admittedly something like 1,000 addresses that are at issue with a highly toxic known substance that's going to cause things like childhood brain damage, which is permanent and irreversible. So when
I'm sorry, go ahead and finish.
Oh, I was just saying, so on balance, a district court, when it's deciding what specific terms it's going to put into an injunction, also an abusive discretion standard of review, needs to balance those sorts of things in determining what's at issue and what needs to be done.
Let's talk about the scope of the court's authority to enjoin a public health nuisance under the statute. The law provides that the commissioner may bring an action to enjoin as a public health nuisance, and I'm skipping to the last clause, any activity or failure to act that adversely affects the public health. And the court found that there was a public health nuisance and then ordered as part of the temporary injunction the cleanup, or not the cleanup, the testing and remediation of employees' homes. How does the testing and cleanup of homes fall within the authority to enjoin an activity or failure to act that adversely affects the public health? That's the issue I'd like to focus on, because for me that's the most challenging argument here.
So the starting point for that assessment, Your Honor, should be what the public health nuisance is. And to be clear, the district court did not find that merely the migration of lead was a public health nuisance, which is, I believe, what was argued a moment ago. Instead, the district court found that the presence of lead and exposure to it in the community, including to the employees, their families, and anyone in the public who happens to be exposed to it, is a public health nuisance.
So we start with that finding. Define public health nuisance as an activity or failure to act that adversely affects the public health. So
yes.
The public health nuisance isn't just the presence of the lead, it's an activity or failure to act, and the court has the authority to enjoin that. So how does that authority include the authority to require remediation or abatement?
So this is a classic example, both in the common law of a prohibitive or mandatory injunction, or in the statute itself, which has both sides of the coin on activities or failures to act. Here, throughout this case, it has been the commissioner's position that Water Gremlin caused a hazard to be emitted from its plant and into the community. Water Gremlin should go clean it up. Water Gremlin refuses to do so. That is a failure to act.
What about 145A.04, which includes in subdivision 8, language requiring removal or abatement of the threat, and then in subdivision 9, the authority to for injunctive relief to enjoin a public health nuisance. So in 145.804, there is language that specifically uses the term abate, but we don't see that in 145A.075.
That's correct.
Is that does that then limit the court's authority under 145A.075 to exclude abatement since it's not specifically included in the statute?
No, it does not, Your Honor. Two reasons. One is one set of statutes, the 140As, are the local Public Health Act that deals with, for example, county agencies administering health programs. 145 is the authority of the commission. The other issue that you're running into is some degree of history in the making as these statutes were rolled out. The authority to issue an injunction to abate was old and was carried forward when the health laws were updated to add this injunctive authority. At that time, the legislature left that language that you were referring to about abatement alone and separately added for both county authorities and the commissioner the authority to bring an injunction against any activity or failure to act that adversely affects the public health.
Just so I'm clear, the statute sort of has three triggers. There's or three points of authority to the court. Enjoining a violation of a statute or a rule, enjoining any activity, and enjoining the failure to act. If I understand your argument now, just so I'm clear on it, your position is not that there was a failure, that there was a violation of a statute or rule that's being enjoined, or an activity that's being enjoined. You're saying that the statute applies because this is the enjoining of a failure to act, and the failure to act is the failure to clean up?
With respect specifically to the in-home.
Yes, I'm talking about the in-home.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the position. So the activities at the plant that are in the process of being updated and addressed as we speak, because the preliminary injunction is ongoing as to most of the terms in the order, those are activities that are being stopped. One of the problems, though, is that those activities over time, before that injunction, which is prohibitive, went into place, the lead already got out. So the classic example in a nuisance is when you let the bull out of the barn, you can be enjoined and you have to go close the barn door. it's also your responsibility to go get the bull and put it back. The classic example from the treatises are the placement of boulders. When you put a boulder on your neighbor's property, you can be told you have to stop doing that, or you can be told you got to go pick it up. That is the difference between a mandatory injunction and a prohibitive one. And so this order has both flavors in it. Both are appropriate.
Only one's being challenged now. I think we're focusing on the one that's being challenged, which is in the homes.
And so the one being challenged is very specific to the mandatory injunction flavor, which is within a district court's discretion to issue. As long as it's...
If that's so, I'm trying to get a sense of whether there is any bound to the authority of the district court under the statute. If it's any failure to act, sorts of things relevant would a district court not be able to enjoin as an abatement requirement?
Sure, Your Honor. So there is a discretionary standard here. So the district court could abuse its discretion here. So it's got to tailor the remedy that it's seeking in the injunction to what it has already found the nuisance to be. Here, the district court found the nuisance to be the presence of lead in the community, and it's ordering Water Gremlin to clean it up. That's closely tied. You could imagine that the court might think of other things that it would want Water Gremlin to do, like wear a silly hat, or something completely out of the bounds of what it would rationally need to do to address the problem that it has identified as a finding of
fact. Let me ask you one more question on that same clause. Judge Cochran was focusing on it a bit. I'll go back to it. The failure to act that adversely affects the public health. Now, the legislature could have said that adversely affects health, but in this case, it's the public health. What distinction, if any, do you see in the statute between health and public health?
So the commissioner's in charge of protecting the public health, and the statute is directed to the public health. Now, to be clear, that doesn't mean that a private nuisance can't affect public health. Indeed, if you...
No, I'm trying to get a sense of whether there's anything that is in one category and not in the other. Give me an example of something that affects public health, or that affects health, but not public health.
So you could imagine perhaps an individual who has cirrhosis of the liver. It's non-communicable, or somebody who has non-communicable cancer, right? There's still public health issues attendant to that, but the district court would have a hard time finding that a specific order directed to that person actually had some effect on others, which I think is going to be the lodestar of when you have an effect on the public. That finding exists here. So we're not getting to these sort of test cases on the facts that exist. We're so far into the public health realm when we've got 1,000 addresses and all the people who come and go through them. It could be the case that in some unforeseen future, a commissioner oversteps his or her bounds and comes close to one of these issues, and that's why they have to go to the district court to get the injunction. There is a check on that specific concern that you have. Now, to be clear, however, public health issues can relate to a single person who might have a communicable disease or a single property. And there are a host of examples that we provide in the respondent's brief where one property may in fact present a public health issue that needs to be addressed. In fact, that exists in the Lead Poisoning Prevention Act. Any one property that receives a lead order that the property owner does not comply with not only can be ordered to go clean it up, but that order can be enforced as, and I quote, a public health nuisance. So the legislature, especially when we're talking about lead contamination, clearly intends something like lead contamination to be a public health nuisance that needs to be addressed. That's equally true for 145.075 as it is in the Lead Poisoning Prevention Act. It would make no sense to read them separately or differently from each other.
So you cited in your brief to the state XRL Swan Lake Area Wildlife Association, the Nicollet County Board decision of this court. And there it talks about, it says a district court possesses the authority to issue an injunction that provides an adequate remedy without imposing unnecessary hardship on the enjoined party. Is that the guiding standard for reviewing, assuming there's a basis to say there's a public health nuisance, but in viewing the scope of an injunction, how does that impact the state's argument here or this case?
So there's two layers to this. The first question about scope is going to be, what is the statutory authority and what does it require or provide for? And if it's within the scope of that, you can move to the next step, which is the injunction appropriate and are the terms appropriate? Now, a district court, especially when we're talking about something which is an extraordinary remedy, a temporary or preliminary injunction, needs to balance the harms and the equities that we're talking about here. On one hand, we have children in our community that we know have been poisoned and are experiencing the potentially lifelong effects of lead poisoning. On the other, we have the risk that maybe, you know, water gremlin didn't cause the lead problem, which, by the way, is not a very likely risk here, considering the affidavit that was submitted where most of the people who had experienced the lead contamination were living in, like, newer housing stock and didn't have other sources for lead. So those equities are really where the court would need to balance it, and that's where the Swan Lake case came in.
I know you're over time here, but just real quickly, was there any inquiry about unnecessary hardship on Water Gremlin, like the costs of the cleanup or of the homes? They voluntarily went ahead and did the cars, I understand.
Sure. Water Gremlin certainly argued that it would be too expensive and it shouldn't have to do it. Whether or not those expenses actually come to bear is going to be another question. We're not there yet. But that's also, to go to Mr. Lightfoot's argument a moment ago about their ability to test whether it's really...
But why aren't you there yet when the court has ordered this relief? Like how, when...
Oh.
Yeah, go ahead.
The district court issued a stay pending this appeal for all forms of relief on the cleanup, except for getting notice out and collecting up folks who are interested in getting the testing done, at which point we hope to have a result. And one of the reasons why we all consented to an expedited appeal in this case was to try to get an answer to that as quickly as possible.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Lightfoot.
Your Honor, we have heard for the first time this morning that state pivot on what the activity is. The state suggested that the failure to act is the failure for Water Gremlin to clean up the homes. That's not what the district court found. In the December 27th order that the district court issued in support of its preliminary injunction order, at paragraph 6 of the order, the district court says that under 145.075, Water Gremlin failed to take steps necessary to prevent its employees from carrying lead off-site. Well, Water Gremlin failed to take steps necessary to prevent its employees from carrying lead off-site.
Well, let's assume you're 100% correct on that. Then why isn't the district court's order an adequate remedy within the meaning of this Nicollet County Board case cited by the state?
Because, Your Honor, the language in Nicollet that was addressed in Nicollet County Board and the statute in Nicollet County Board is different than the statute in 145. The language in 145.075 does not use the term abate. And no matter how much the commissioners wish it did, it's not there. So to suggest that 145A or the Lead Poisoning Act, Prevention Act in 144 or something else that specifically has language regarding abatement applies to 145 is not the case. You can't read that language in there if it's not in the statute. That's the first point, Your Honor. And the second point is this. The abatement orders that are directed in Nicollet County and in 144 and 145A and all of those other cases require abatement of property that is owned, a public nuisance, of property that is owned by the party. It is the party, the property owner, that gets the abatement order, not a third party.
isn't that just defined by the terms of the statute itself? In other words, couldn't the legislature have included language that required abatement of the public health nuisance by the party that created the public health nuisance?
They could have, but they didn't, Your Honor. There's nothing in 145.075 that allows the Minnesota Department of Health to chase the lead. The language
There's
just isn't in the statute.
There's nothing excluded either, is there? And under the MIRA statute, which the Nicollet County Board was based on, the word abate doesn't exist there. It says for declaratory or equitable relief.
For
so it's
cleanup.
Talking about general, well, that's kind of what we're talking about here. If the failure to act here is failure to prevent migration of lead outside the facility, then isn't the adequate remedy at least cleaning things up and not allowing lead to migrate in the future?
The adequate remedy is cleaning things up at the plant and not allowing lead to migrate in the future. The idea of to take this statute, the statutes dealing with the cleanup of hazardous substance are very different than a statute that allows for a preliminary injunction to prevent a public health nuisance.
But be the public policy purpose of requiring Water Gremlin to stop lead from migrating, but not requiring Water Gremlin to deal with the existing public health problem that was created by the public health nuisance, assuming we find that agree that there is a public health nuisance?
It was, again, it was created by the activity or the failure to act. That is the limitation
but
in the statute,
the,
with
why,
which Mr. Sirdo says.
Why would it be logical for the legislature to say courts can enjoin this problem that's going on, but courts can't require the actor to address the public health nuisance that was the public health problem that was created by the public health nuisance?
Your Honor, it may or may not be logical, but that's the way the statute is written, and it is contrary to public policy to expand the language or expand the remedy of the statute to suggest that there a remedy that is there that is not.
Can I ask you this so I understand? Give an example of a failure to an enjoinable failure to act that adversely affects the public health. I'm focusing on the failure to act because I understand what it means to enjoin an activity or to enjoin a violation, but what is the enjoining of a failure to act?
Let's say go back to the days when individuals were tainting Tylenol bottles. Let's say that a manufacturer knew that an individual had been tainting bottles of Tylenol and that those were in commerce, but the manufacturer did nothing to do so. That would be an enjoinable failure to act that would threaten the public health or a public health nuisance. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. The case is submitted. It's obviously an interesting case, and your arguments were very helpful to us, and we will be issuing a decision within the statute.